Hello, this is James Stansel. Welcome to the New Books Network, the African American Studies channel. I'm your host. And today we have the pleasure of talking to White Robes, Silver Screens, Movies and the Making of the Ku Klux Klan. The author is Tom Rice, and the book is published by Indiana University Press. Tom comes to us from the University of St. Andrews in the UK. I had a great conversation with him. He's a fun guy, very nice guy. He talks with you a little bit about why he was interested in this topic, the research that took place, as well as, you know, the importance of Ku Klux Klan and hate groups like that and social media. Social media of that time was movies and films and such. Today, you know, you have an alt-right movement in the United States, and they use the internet as well as email and other types of media. So we made that comparison. He talks about some of the prominent films, Birth of a Nation, The Black Legion and such. That relate to the Ku Klux Klan. I really think you'll find this to be a very interesting interview. And the book is White Robes, Silver Screens, Movies and the Making of the Ku Klux Klan by Dr. Tom Rice of the University of St. Andrews in the UK. So I'll step out of the way, give it a listen. The New Books Network, African American Studies Channel. Hello, this is James Stansel, and welcome to the New Books Network, the African American Studies Channel. I have the great pleasure today of speaking with someone across the pond, as they say, Dr. Tom Rice of the University of St. Andrews. He's a lecturer in film studies, and we're going to be talking with him today on the New Books Network about his book, White Robes, Silver Screens, Movies and the Making of the Ku Klux Klan. And this book is published by Indiana University Press. Hello, Dr. Rice. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, James. Lovely to speak to you today.
Absolutely. And, you know, we talked a little offline about the fact that I was looking forward, really greatly looking forward to talking with you about this book, because for us here in the United States, this is very relevant now. You know, we have a new president, and there's the rebirth of what people call the alt-right movement, a white nationalist, white separatist movement. And some people are concerned over here about fake news and fake stories and, you know, increases in hate crimes and such. So I think a book like yours, White Robes and Silver Screens, Movies and the Making of the Ku Klux Klan, is absolutely relevant for today's world here in the United States and probably internationally as well.
Yeah, no, I think unfortunately you're absolutely right in that when I was researching it and started writing it, I don't think I realized how relevant it would become by the time it was released this year. And you're absolutely right. There are, although it's a historical study from the teens really through to the 40s, so it's kind of interwar period, I think there are such strong parallels between then and today. And as you said, we see the Klan and the far right, this discourse coming up again. We see repetition in the kind of language that was being used in the 20s and today. We see discussions about the Klan itself, the way that there've been, you know, there was a Hillary Clinton campaign video which was directly linking Trump to the Klan and these kinds of things. There were clear attempts to use the Klan as well in these discussions. And also, I just think in the way that, as my book argues, the ways in which the Klan were using the media in the 20s, we see parallels between then and now in the kind of the use of media. Mm-hmm. The actual media forms may change, but I think there are strong parallels in the kind of the devices they're using, the language that's being used. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the kind of parallels we can draw out from the book.
Absolutely. And, you know, thank you for that so much, Tom. And, you know, before we really get into, you know, the nuts and bolts and stuff about the book, I know my listeners love to learn a little bit about the authors themselves, you know, about, you know, can you tell us a little bit about your background academically, you know, as well as, you know, what drew you to this topic and what types of things did you do to research this book?
Sure. Well, it's a good question. And as you say, I'm based in the UK, so it's not an obvious topic, perhaps you would think. My own background, really, this was as a university student, I was studying history and I was also studying film studies. So those were two backgrounds, really. And I'm sure, like a lot of people, I took a brilliant course on on American race relations. That was the topic of a kind of year-long course in my final year. And at the same time, I was interested in early cinema. So the two kind of merging and coming together. After I finished my undergraduate, I had the opportunity to do a PhD, which was originally looking at the kind of representation of the Ku Klux Klan on film. But it changed quite quickly. I worked with Dr. Lee Greaveson, who is at the University College of London, and he really helped shape the work as well and my ideas, so that it became much more about the ways in which the Klan used cinema and the ways in which it was producing its own films and these kinds of things, rather than simply about the ways it had been represented on screen. So I it was a kind of a very long process in some ways. And I did this PhD a long time ago now, and not too long ago, I should
say. I was going to say, it doesn't look that long ago.
Okay, I need to defend that. But I did that, and then I worked on another couple of projects afterwards.
Okay.
And always wanted to go back to this study and to really expand on some of the areas that had interested me. And then that's what I've been doing over the last few years, actually pulling it apart, going back through the research, finding new areas to explore, making new connections. And I think having that distance really helped me as well, you know, going back to the material again. But in terms of my actual, you mentioned there about how I research this as well. And it, as you'll probably, you know, as you can see from the notes and the bibliography, it was a lot of, there was quite a lot of travel. So it was, you know, I spent a fair amount of time in the States, in Indiana and Ohio and New York and Washington and further afield. And, but also I was incredibly fortunate that there were lots of very generous libraries and archivists and things who answered my questions. And also, I guess in the last few years, we've seen, an increase in, you know, digitized materials and things like this as well, means that the ways in which we research is changing as well. So I was fortunate there, but it was quite a, it's been quite a long process in that way, going back to the material again, I suppose.
But, you know, like you said, sometimes it's good to have a bit of distance, or, you know, professional distance, and not try to do it all at one time, because as you get older and you mature, you develop new skills. You know, you can come back and approach that a topic again and find some new, you know, ways to look at it, or some different ways to do it. So for those of you out there who are interested in becoming researchers like Dr. Rice, or, you know, one of your favorite scholars you've heard here on the New Books Network, you know, listen to some of these tips and things that he's sharing. Thank you for sharing that, Dr. Rice.
Yeah, and no, I think it is a good point, because you do also sometimes get very attached to an idea or a sentence or whatever it is, and I think that's never going, you know, that's the center of the book. And then when you look back on it later on with a bit of distance, you think, oh no, that doesn't work. That doesn't, you know, and it's easier to get rid of it. So yeah, editing is always the key part. And, you know, I tend to write and then spend a lot of time on the editing as well.
And we're here on the New Books Network, the African American Studies channel. I'm your host, James Stansel, and I'm here today with Dr. Tom Rice of the University of St. Andrews in the UK. He is a lecturer in film studies, and we're talking about his book, White Robes, Silver Screens, Movies and the Making of the Ku Klux Klan. Movies and the Making of the Ku Klux Klan. And this is a book that's published by Indiana University Press. And it's really interesting, you know, that it's Indiana University Press, considering the connection between the state of Indiana and the Ku Klux Klan.
Absolutely. I mean, that was a conscious decision. I mean, Indiana have been, I mean, it's a great press, and they've got a really good film history, film history collection. So it was a very good fit, and they've been brilliant with the book. But at the same time, there was a kind of local element to it as well. As you say, a lot of this history is in the Midwest, and you know, I take examples of films that were produced by Klan groups in Indiana. Mm-hmm. I use examples of particular cinemas in Indiana that were owned by Klansmen. So I take specific examples from that area. So, yeah, it it felt like I'm not sure I sold it to them quite in that way. But I think there is a local element to it as well as the fact that they were great with the book. So yeah,
absolutely. I mean, this book has a great cover, and I definitely feel like it's something that's accessible to, you know, not just scholarly types or the academic, but the average person, you know, a person who's interested in film. I mean, you know, it's lots of great documentation. You heard Dr. Rice mention his notes section. It's very extensive. He did outstanding research here. And again, the book is White Rose, Silver Screens, Movies, and the Making of the Ku Klux Klan, published by Indiana University Press. And I'm here on the New Books Network, the African American Studies channel. I'm James Stansel, and I'm here with Dr. Tom Rice at the University of St. Andrews in the UK. So if you hear someone who sounds maybe a little different than what you've been hearing on the New Books Network, you still tune into the right place. Because Dr. Rice is from the UK, but his book and his topic is about film studies and history of the Ku Klux Klan. And so I guess at this point, Dr. Rice, we should probably get into a little bit about some of what you consider them your major points or your major findings in your book, sure, if you could share with us.
Yeah, so in some ways, I guess the starting point for the book and the starting point for my own research and interest, sure, in the subject was a history that maybe some people will already know and will be, mm-hmm, familiar to, which is The Birth of a Nation. So the release, right, of this film, D.W. Griffith film.
The original Birth of a Nation.
The original Birth of a Nation. Sorry, I need to now clarify and say original Birth of a Nation in 1915, so 100 years ago. And it was released when it played in Atlanta in early December of 1915. A new Ku Klux Klan group had been founded, mm-hmm, a couple of weeks before. That new group advertised in the local paper next to a poster for The Birth of a Nation.
Wow.
They reportedly paraded at the opening of the film. So that was the kind of starting point for the book, in a way. That was kind of the visual starting point. Mm-hmm. This idea that a film had in some ways kind of sparked or ignited a new group, this modern Klan group, which initially sparked my interest. But then I really wanted to say, well, what happened after this? You know, what's the bigger history here, mm-hmm, about the ways which this group goes from really being, you know, in 1919, it has 4,000 or 5,000 members. And then by the mid 1920s, it has a figure near 5 million. You know, how do we explain,
wow,
that growth and the ways in which this group becomes kind of embedded in society, you know, in local communities, the ways in which you have, I mean, some of the research, you know, the things you find out about this group, you have this perception today of what we think the Klan is and was. And then I was reading these newspapers and finding, you know, pictures of Klansmen attending church services and attending, you know, school bake sales and Klan baseball teams and all these kinds of things. And so I was really trying to understand this growth, mm-hmm, and see the media and film played in this expansion. So, on the one hand, I guess it's a history of the Klan, but it's also a history of film and media, of, right, the ways in which groups use film and media to further their aims and their politics. And, mm-hmm, you know, the what was interesting was that, as I said before, I thought this was going to be initially a project about how Hollywood has represented the Klan, mm-hmm, and that's one part of it. But actually, what I found was a group that was protesting against film, you know, establishing itself as a kind of social reformer, as this big player in the kind of debates that were going on in Hollywood about censorship and all these kinds of things. Mm. Also as a producer of film, as an exhibitor of film. Mm. So I became interested in the kind of the wider ways in which it used film and media, the fact that it had, you know, lots of newspapers, that it radio shows, it put on big public events, it had this kind of big network of media performance that I was interested in. So that that's kind of the direction that the book took there, I think, was this wider use of media by this group.
By the return of, you know, the developing Klan at that time.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, you have like a U.S. president that that applauded, and, you know, what did he say? Was history written in lightning, I think, or something like that, describing the birth of a nation?
Well, he was supposed to say that. Whether he did or not, I don't know. But it was a good bit of publicity, and it's a good bit of kind of legitimizing the, you know, the group by aligning, as it did, by kind of aligning itself to these kind of, you know, these prominent figures. Right. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think, but you know, I thought, okay, this is about the birth of a nation initially, but actually when you consider that the birth of a nation came out in 1915 and the Klan was not actually particularly prominent for another 5 years.
Right, not yet.
So then it became, okay, well how is it using other films? How is it using other media that we're not aware of and we're not yet, we haven't researched? So it ranged from things like the Klan protesting against a Charlie Chaplin film because Chaplin was ridiculing, as they said, the Protestant ministry. They saw him as so they campaigned against films that it thought were criticizing its values and its morals. Mm-hmm. So they campaigned against what they called the Paramount sex plays, you know, films of films that had morals that they didn't approve of. So they were campaigning against specific films as well. And I found that, you know, I part of the research was looking through Klan newspapers and, you know, which is not what I would choose to do in my, I should add, but it was amazing to see how they were using the kind of language, how they were using these existing debates, these concerns that were there in society, that other, you know, women's groups and religious groups were saying these same things, but the Klan were now jumping in on those debates and also were turning them around so that rather than, so that, for example, when they were campaigning against films, they were often criticizing what it saw as kind of Jewish and Catholic influences in America and in Hollywood particularly. So they used it to further their very particular agendas.
And now I was going to mention, I'm glad you mentioned that about Catholicism, because when you mentioned, you know, the Charlie Chaplin issue and, you know, denigrating, you know, maybe the Protestant faith, you know, a lot of people who aren't as familiar with the history of the Klan don't realize that their issues didn't just stop with you know, black people or people of darker skin. I mean, they had issues with, particularly during this time, immigrants of all types, right? Catholics and other groups.
Absolutely. I think that again, you know, without wishing to draw parallels across time, I think that it's the targets change at different moments in history in a way.
Right.
So in 1915, with the birth of a nation, obviously we had the African-American targeting the film. In 1920, when there is a film that the Klan put on and present called The Face at Your Window, the target is what they call a Bolshevik Jew at the time of the Red Scare in America. So they have a different target at that moment. And then, as you say, in the 20s, more often they're concerned with Jewish and Catholic influences in film and in Hollywood. So you're absolutely right. It's not to say that, certainly not to kind of downplay the threats and the ways they represented other races and groups. But I think the Jewish and Catholic targets were very pronounced in the 20s. And
absolutely,
that really comes out in the ways in which the Klan kind of articulate this in their films and in their newspapers and things.
And so you mentioned Birth of a Nation, and you mentioned, you know that film Face, I think it's Face at the Window, right?
Yeah,
Face in the Window. What were some other, you know, I can think, I know one that I'm particularly interested in, but I'll get to that, and that's the Black Legion. But you know maybe can you share with some of our listeners some of the other films that are maybe prominent is probably the wrong word, but you know, well-known or, you know, or any type of Hollywood-type films that they may be familiar with or not familiar with that you talk about in your book here that relate to the Klan?
Yeah, absolutely. So, as you said, there are films like there's a Mary Pickford film from 1919. Now, Mary Pickford, known as America's Sweetheart, Canadian, but never mind. but she was in a film called Heart of the Hills, where she dresses up. She plays a Knight Rider. She's effectively dressed in robes, and that was in 1919. So in the book, I talk about the ways in which the image is used in other films, and the ways in which, even though the Klan itself may not be, it may not be described as the Klan on screen, we see this image used as a source of excitement or as a source of, as a kind of law enforcing group in a number of films. So there's that with Mary Pickford. There are, as I said, stars like Chaplin, you even find things like Buster Keaton films where they use the Klan to exploit or advertise the film. There are films that the Klan made themselves. So I talk in the book about a number of films made by local groups. There's one called The Toll of Justice, which there is a copy that it does still exist. I mean, I wouldn't seek it out, but it's an example. It was very useful for me as a researcher because not only in many cases I was writing about films that no longer exist, so you're having to piece this together from publicity materials or posters or other documents that you might have. But The Toll of Justice, we do have there is a version of the film around as well. There were other films, like there was one called The Traitor Within, The Mysterious Eyes of the Ku Klux Klan. You get an idea just from the title of what they're doing. And then, as you say, into the 30s, in the 20s, I think often the Klan is not as directly addressed. I mean, maybe that's because, as I argue, partly because it is very prominent, it's very topical, and exhibitors are keen to exploit that. Exhibitors are keen to make a connection. But producers, with censorship and things like that, often either avoid the topic or present it in a slightly different way. So, for example, there are some films which do feature the Klan, but rather than the Klan targeting racial or religious targets, instead the Klan has to target, for example, the owner of a drinking establishment or something like this.
Okay.
And one of the effects of that is that actually you present a kind of a group that is in some ways seen to be kind of law enforcing or moral, which is so the fact that you can't represent the targets creates that issue. Into the 30s, you mentioned Black Legion there, which is it's a good example because that's a Humphrey Bogart film, and one of his early ones, and it doesn't actually, it's officially not the Klan on screen.
Right.
The Klan sued Warner Brothers because they said that they sued them for $112,000 because they said that the Warners had used their patented insignia in the film. They lost the case, but it was it's a typical move by the Klan at that time, in that it was gaining publicity. It was exploiting the popular interest in film in Hollywood. And it also shows how conscious the Klan was about its image, actually the image was incredibly important. And that image was created and popularized through film, really. So the ways in which the fiery cross, the costume, which is how it made most of its money as well, was through the membership and sales of these images with this costume, how important that image was for the group. And that's another way in which film is incredibly important in this period.
I actually own a DVD copy of The Black Legion.
Do you? Okay.
Yeah. In doing some research, on the Ku Klux Klan, for history classes, I came across this, because it was, Humphrey Bogart,
Absolutely.
I'm familiar with the story that you said, about them not really naming the Ku Klux Klan in the movie, but it was pretty obvious, you know, who they were talking about. And so I always found that film, you know, quite fascinating for that reason. And, you know, and I'm familiar, of course, with The Birth of a Nation. I think, you know, many people are familiar with that. They may not be as familiar with Black Legion, but they probably can look it up now that we've talked about it a little bit.
Because, absolutely. And I think it's an interesting film also because it's a moment when the Klan has in many ways, you know, it's fallen from influence and its membership is a tiny proportion of what it was in the 20s. Right. So you have a number of films in the late 30s that now start to critique the Klan and show the Klan as a, you know, corrupt, violent force, as un-American. Whereas in the 20s, that debate and discussion is still going on through these films. So there's a sense in which those films also allow us to see the kind of end of this period and the ways in which the Klan fade. Gone with the Wind's another one, of course, where, you know, the Klan are in the book, but they're not in the film. And, well, they're not directly mentioned in the film. And Klan newspapers complained about this and presented this as a Jewish distortion of history. That's how they phrased this in the papers. But they also tried to, they reportedly offered to parade at the premiere of the film. So, which unsurprisingly was turned down, but there was this...
right.
Again, we've got this idea of the ways in which the group was trying to use film, was trying to exploit the media and the kind of inherent interest in the subject, the image, the performance, those kinds of things across this time.
And I'm here with Dr. Tom Rice of the University of St. Andrews in the UK. He's a lecturer in film studies, and we're talking about his book. This is a book published by Indiana University Press. I definitely recommend it. It's called White Robes, Silver Screens, Movies and the Making of the Ku Klux Klan. So if you're a person, if you're interested in film history, film studies, or if you're interested in like the Jim Crow era, segregation, and how those different subject areas kind of cross each other, this is a good book for you. And I know we're getting a little short of time, but definitely wanted you to talk about maybe a few more films that people may be familiar with from the book.
Sure. So
familiar with.
No, exactly. We're not familiar. Well, there are, as I said, there are films that the Klan protested against as well. So there were films with titles like Paramount Films and titles like Manhandle, The Enemy Sex, Changing Husbands.
Oh my goodness.
A film called The Female, which promised to show its star more nearly nude than she's yet appeared on screen. And obviously these are the kinds of films that the Klan condemned and criticized. And in doing that, it was presenting itself as a kind of moral guardian. So what we see here is the ways in which the Klan is trying to position itself within, not just within local groups, but also as a kind of national voice, you know, as an influence on national policy. Mm. So you see it aligning with lots of other groups, whether it's, as I said, women's groups or religious groups or particular Protestant groups or the American Legion or whoever it may be. Doesn't mean those other groups were in any way trying to.
Right.
As I should point out, but they were recognizing the potential here. And similarly, you know, you have, I talk a lot, not just about the films that they showed or films that we may know, but also about things like how these films were advertised and how they were exhibited. So you have theaters, as I said, that were owned by the Klan, but you also have the Klan recognized that the film could do a job if people went to see the film, but equally, the advertisements for the films, which might be put in local papers, they might be on, you know, bus stations or whatever it would be. These were ways in which they could promote their values. Mm-hmm. So the posters would often say, you know, the film that every 100% American should see, or red-blooded American. And they would have at the bottom, they might have catch lines like, do away with divorce, protect clean womanhood, you know, mm-hmm. protect Americanism. And in that way, what we see is the ways in which the Klan was using film to not just the films itself, but rather all the publicity around it mm-hmm. to project itself within the local community. And you see in some of these communities just how embedded it becomes, you know, how it manages to become a kind of legitimate organization almost in some of these communities. And it's you know, hard now with to kind of imagine how this happens, but at the same time we can see how
yes we can
how you know these ideas become kind of normalized, you know, they become they become kind of embedded in communities here. And I think it's, you know, I found part of the challenge, of course, was actually finding these examples. So finding the cinemas that are owned by Klansmen or whatever it may be, because that's not necessarily something you would think would be widely advertised.
Right,
But you see it in the language. So there was a theater which advertised itself as cool, cozy, and clean with the three Ks. they would use particular language each week and would say, you know, we only show the most moral American productions and these kinds of things. So there were ways in which they were clearly talking to particular groups in this time as well. So there were not just the films that interested me, but also, I guess, the exhibition, the ways these were shown, things like the censorship of films. So I was interested in that, in what wasn't shown on screen as well.
Right.
So, you know, when I was thinking about how Hollywood responded to the Klan in the 20s, you know, what was, how does that respond and how can it respond? So I was interested in things like censorship, things like, you know, a figure like Oscar Michaud, who people know about a bit already.
Great African-American filmmaker, right.
Thinking about how he fits into these debates as well, you know, how he attempted to confront the Klan on film to challenge some of the images that were dominant at the time. So thinking about these kind of debates that are feeding in there as well.
Okay. And we're here with Dr. Tom Rice of the University of St. Andrews in the UK. He's a lecturer in film studies, and we're talking about his book from Indiana University Press, White Robes, Silver Screens, Movies, and the Making of the Ku Klux Klan. White Robes, Silver Screens, Movies, and the Making of the Ku Klux Klan. And so, Tom, I guess, you know, we've kind of talked about it a little bit, but I guess I have to ask the obvious question. before they had social media, you know, you had films and you had these advertisements, and that was how white nationalists and white supremacist types, got their message out there and such. And now in 2016, at least in the United States, you're having a bit of a rise or, a return of some of these groups to prominence. You know, they're kind of known as the alt-right here.
Yeah.
You know, would you be able to make, you think, a direct comparison between what the Ku Klux Klan did with films and movies and some of these social media websites and such that the alt-right movement is using in today's world?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there is, as I said, I think there is a clear link there, or at least a parallel that we can draw. I mean, I think one of the important points is that the moment that I was looking at, this moment in history between kind of, as I said, there's this Red Scare in 1919, and then there's the big the Immigration Act in 1924. And this is a moment when there's this real kind of heightened patriotic fervor, you know, heightened conservatism.
Right.
And I think there's a parallel between that moment and the moment today.
Mm.
In particular, say, the use of media. Absolutely, I think we see it in the language. So the discourse is around something like Americanism, as I've discussed already. The ways in which the Klan projected itself as a kind of underdog. You know, here you've got a group of white males,
sure.
predominantly, and women actually, but projecting itself as a kind of using the language of minority groups and things like that as well, present itself as a kind of threatened force here in America in the teens and 20s. But I think what you see most of all is the way it managed to normalize its views and its ideas and to present them as to manage to maneuver into the mainstream effectively. That's what we see. We see this group maneuver into the mainstream to become a kind of legitimate force within the country. You know, it's a prominent social and political force in the 20s. As I said, we're looking at 5 million members. We're talking about senior political figures. We're talking about
future presidents.
And I think there's a real danger of dismissing that moment and of thinking of dismissing what we think the Klan is, because actually there is a parallel there in how it uses media with then and now. And I think that's a useful parallel to kind of draw out and to recognize, you know, if we can't learn lessons from history, then, you know, what's the point of history? You know, we're doomed to repeat it. Exactly. So I think there are lessons we can pull out there. I mean,
absolutely. And so, yeah, we're here, White Robes, Silver Screens. We're here with Dr. Tom Rice of the University of St. Andrews in the UK, and his book, White Robes, Silver Screens, Movies and the Making of the Ku Klux Klan. It's published by Indiana University Press. And Dr. Rice, thank you so much for taking time with us to talk about your book. You know, I feel like I could talk with you all evening, but I know it's late in the evening for you, and you got to get home and get to your family and friends and relax after a long day at work, right?
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. I know. I better get back eventually. I've got two kids who are waiting for me at home, so can't stay here forever. I know, as tempting as it would be. Yeah.
Absolutely. So yeah, definitely tell them their new friend James said hello from Houston, Texas.
They will be very impressed with that. They will like that.
And apologize for me in advance for keeping Dad from getting home to them.
That's good. Yeah, exactly. I will let them know it's all your fault. That's fine.
Yeah, absolutely. And before we go, you know, I just wanted to give you a chance to, Tom, if you wanted to talk about any current research you're doing or classes you're teaching or any future books or, you know, anything that you want to talk about that you want to share with the audience, because, you know, I'd like them to know about other things our authors are working on as well or have worked on.
Great. Thank you. I'm working on another book at the moment, which is in the kind of writing stages, and that's on I'm looking at the British Empire now, so I am moving. I'm moving out of the States to looking at the British Empire and looking at the ways in which the British government used film during the kind of 30s, 40s, 50s. So at the end of the British Empire, the ways in which the government used film to try and, in some ways, kind of create these British citizens all around the world. So looking at how it used film in Africa, in the Caribbean, in Malaysia, and other parts of the British Empire. So in some ways, there are quite close parallels with what I was doing in the White Robe Silver Screens, in that interest is in the kind of ways in which film is used by governments or political groups to kind of further their aims and their goals, and in some ways to kind of promote a model of citizenship and to bring a group together. Okay. So that's the project I'm working on at the minute. It is, I'm in the writing process. So, my head is somewhere there and here as well. So, but I'm hoping that will be, I will finish that, you know, by the end of next year. And then who knows exactly. So I did work for a few years after I, in between on this project, I worked on a project on colonial film at the British Film Institute in
BFI.
BFI, absolutely, in the UK. And for that, we produced a website where we made lots of these films available around the world.
Wow.
I know we get, I've had lots of nice comments from people in the States who have been able to see these films and read my work through that in a way that obviously now we're able to present this material in more interesting ways. So it's great that those films are more widely available and people are able to view them and to read the scholarship alongside the films. I know they're used in in teaching, things like that. So
yeah, that sounds awesome.
That was a really fun project to work on because, as you mentioned earlier, I think one of the nice things with any bits of work we do is mm-hmm. being able to bring it to a wider audience and not just see it as, you know, a piece of scholarship or something right. that is exclusively for, you know, people in universities or whatever. I absolutely think these are histories and stories that are of interest and I hope of relevance to, you know, much wider group, and that people can draw out, you know, lessons and interest from the history. So that was the aim.
Yeah, and that sounds great. And you definitely did that with White Road Silver Screens. It certainly, you know, piqued my interest and attracted my attention. And I think it will do that for others here in the United States as well. So, you know, definitely thank you for that, Tom Rice, you know, for your research. And I think it's going to be invaluable for people, you know, film study scholars, film historians and such in future years for these things that you did, you know, looking into some of these early works that involve the Ku Klux Klan. So definitely I wanted to personally thank you for doing that work and that research. So.
Thank you. That's very kind. And as you say, I think you always hope with these things that it will lead other people to, to do their own work and to you know, challenge it and to come up with new research as well. So I hope that it leads to, you know, more discussion and debate and brings the issue forward again. So, yeah, thank you.
So do you think you'll ever maybe, I guess sequel is the wrong thing to say for for a book, but maybe look at the Ku Klux Klan in films in, you know, in more recent years or more recent times, because they've definitely been portrayed in the last 5 or 10 years with some of these slavery era films.
Absolutely. I mean, you're absolutely right. There have been quite a few in the last few years, even at the beginning of the century, with things like, you know, Brother, Where Art Thou? And
right.
I think Bad Boys 2 had a sequel. You know, they're quite big films. Had
Blazing these, Saddles.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. These kind of moments in as well. So I probably wouldn't. The prospect of a sequel doesn't, doesn't fill me. Don't plan on making this a trilogy. But I think in some ways the aspect that interests me most is this kind of use of media. So maybe thinking beyond just film and thinking as you mentioned, very astutely in your question earlier about the ways in which social media works today and things like this as well. And so I there are interesting areas that I would, you know, I might work in on there. At the same time, it is, I'm okay with having a break from researching the class for a bit.
Yeah, You had to sacrifice yourself a little bit to help others. I'm sure that wasn't your favorite topic to.
I mean, it was always intriguing. That's the thing. I mean, you know, I think it's a subject that people have an awareness of already, which was what kind of excited me about it.
Right.
Was that you mentioned the topic and people have ideas already. They know bits about it. Mm. So that is great as a researcher because you then have the challenge of, of working with a topic that people have very strong feelings about already.
Already gotten their attention.
Exactly. So that was, that's a nice starting point for a topic, I think.
Absolutely. And I would love to get you back on the New Books Network when you complete your next book. So, you know, we can talk about that in the future. My audience.
Great.
We'd love to hear about that one as well. And, you know, audience, we're going to let Dr. Rice go get to his kids. I don't want to hold him any longer. So thank you so much, Dr. Rice, for your time. And I'm here with Tom Rice, White Road Silver Screens, Movies and the Making of the Ku Klux Klan. This book is published by Indiana University Press. And definitely, if you're interested in film history, about the Ku Klux Klan race relations in the 20th century, definitely check this book out. And so on that note, Tom, if you can say goodbye to the audience for me, and we'll be done for today.
Great. Okay. Well, thanks, James. Thanks, anyone, for listening. And really lovely to speak to you today.
Absolutely. And on that note, I'll see you next time on the New Books Network, the African American Studies channel. I'm your host, James Stenzel. Take care. Okay, we're back, and this is James Stansel, the host of the African American Studies channel on the New Books Network, and I hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Tom Rice of the University of St. Andrews in the United Kingdom, the UK, his book White Robes, Silver Screens, Movies and the Making of a Ku Klux Klan. He's a great film scholar. He did great research on this book. I hope you enjoyed that interview, and I hope you'll check out his book. You know, there's not many books about the Ku Klux Klan and their film history, and he did a really good job in his research. So on that note, take care, and I'll see you next time on the African American Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, James Stansel. Take care.